So I think the rebound is going to be extraordinarily strong. We're seeing property values in Manhattan today on a price per square foot basis that are the same as they were 15 or 20 years ago.
Let's get ready to scale. Hey guys, thanks for tuning in for yet another episode. I'm very excited to have the one and only Bob Knackle joining us today. Bob is a senior managing director at JLL, where he leads the New York Private Capital Group. He is the chairman and founding partner of Massey Knackle Realty Services. To date, Bob has personally been responsible for the sale of over 2,000 buildings, generally considered to be the highest total ever for a single broker in New York, and over $18 billion in sales. He is the author of a weekly column on the New York City real estate market called Concrete Thoughts for the Commercial Observer. He is a two-time winner of the Real Estate Board of New York's Robert T. Lawrence Award for the Most Ingenious Deal of the Year concert. He graduated with a BS in economics from the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's coming to us from New York City. Bob, super excited to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Jeanette, great to be with you today.
That is quite a track record, Bob, and I am very excited to have the opportunity to ask you all kinds of questions. So I'm just going to jump straight in because there's so many things I want to know from your perspective. So first of all, just to kind of, give everybody a little bit more insight into your background, can you tell us about what type of assets it is that you broker and how you essentially, quote, got in the game?
Sure. Well, I've been a generalist all my life, and that is changing, hopefully, and I'll explain why. But I got into the real estate business completely by accident. 1981, I'm a freshman at the Wharton School, wanted to be the next Gordon Gekko like every other Wharton kid, and was looking for a summer job at a commercial bank or investment bank in northern New Jersey where I grew up. I came out of a Payne Weber office across the hall. I saw Coldwell Banker, walked in with my resume thinking the place was a bank. One thing led to another. They were the only ones who were hiring college kids for the summer. So took the job, loved it, went back my next two summers, started with CB in Manhattan when I got out of school, met a guy named Paul Massey. We became partners. That partnership lasted 30 years. After 4 years of running sales at CB in Manhattan, we left to form Massey Knackle. It started with just the two of us and a secretary, built it up to 250 people in four offices in New York, sold it to Cushman & Wakefield at the end of 2014. And the success of that business really was based on a geographical approach to the business. We had one broker working in each neighborhood. We called those neighborhoods territory. It was very much like a residential farming approach where we literally went on every block and called every owner around every block, went to the next block. And in those days, the amount of publicly available information was so opaque, it was tough to get. So the geographic approach to the business really worked well. Today, with the voluminous amount of publicly available data, I think a product specialization is more important than the geographic specialization. So, over the years, I've sold all types of properties. But today, my main focus really is on selling land, which development sites in Manhattan generally consist of a lot of small buildings that need to be demolished to make a piece of land, because there aren't a lot of pastures out there just sitting empty. And I sell a lot of multifamily properties also. So a combination of those two, what I'm focusing on these days.
Fantastic. I love the story. It's inspiring. It definitely shows that you've also had to adapt with the changing times, and you have to, modify the strategies and approaches that we take, and the implementation of technology as well. So you have seen a lot. And that is why, I'm really curious to know what your take is on the current state of the market when it comes to New York, since you happen to have so much expertise specifically in this market. There have been a lot of grim headlines that have been coming out, and it may be sensationalism, with a splash of truth, or it may be a lot of truth you know, with only a splash of sensationalism, but some headlines that we've seen recently, you know, New York City commercial real estate sales volume down 53% in Q1. Nearly $1.5 trillion in commercial mortgages is coming due over the next 3 years, and many landlords are vulnerable to default. Those are just two examples of headlines that my team was able to find in 10 seconds. So, Bob, you know, being that you are boots on the ground, you are deeply, you know, deeply invested, literally, you know, in this market. What is your take on the current state of the market in New York, and where is it going to go from here?
Well, Jeanette, I think to understand the state of the market, you know, absolute numbers don't mean much. Everything in real estate is based on the relative relationship between numbers. So I like to talk in statistics rather than adjectives. And just to go to 40,000 feet and explain what's going on in New York, the cyclical peak in this period of time clearly was all the way back in 2014 and 2015. In 2014, 5,534 buildings were sold in New York City. That was an all-time record by more than 10%. In 2015, we had $80.1 billion in dollar volume of sales, also an all-time record. But the market changed at the beginning of the fourth quarter of 2015. I think there was a realization that the condo sales market was not as deep as people were hoping. It started to have some downward pressure being exerted on residential rents. Movements in the residential market always precede movements in the commercial market. So that was a little bit of a red flag. But we also saw the first couple of weeks of September, all of a sudden the bids on our development sites were down 15 or 20% from expectation. We also saw cap rates in the hotel space go up by 75 to 100 basis points. Those two asset classes are really important because they move before other asset classes move. Hotels, because leases are for one day. Land, because land is a proxy for the way developers view market conditions 3 or 4 years from today, when what they're buying is going to actually be built and come to market. So we knew that the bull market kind of was over at the beginning of October of 2015. From October of 15 through February of 2020, the dollar volume of sales dropped by 56%. The number of properties sold dropped by 54%. And then in March of 2020, COVID comes along and converts this mostly volume correction into a value correction. Values in sectors, particularly in Manhattan, were hit particularly hard. Land, hotels, and retail were down about 50% from their peak levels. And, you know, the market really was in a tough spot in late 2020. And then the market kind of shifted in the beginning of the second quarter of 2021. In that first week of April, all the residential brokers came out with their reports, which showed upward pressure being exerted on residential rents for the first time in years. Condo absorption was positive. And within a 3-day period, I was called by 13 private equity shops that said, "Bob, we're getting off the sidelines. Who's building? Who's developing? Who's investing? We need to put money into the market." And sure enough, that led to a relatively robust second half of 21 and first half of 22. I thought we were coming out of what was the longest correction in the history of the New York market, even during the savings and loan crisis in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. It was only a 4-year correction. Here we were longer than that. And you know, that 12-month period, 2H21, 1H22 was a great period of time. And then the Fed starts raising interest rates in March. By April, September, spreads are blown out, really started to impact the market. And then values started to head down again. So we're in a market now that is, you know, suffering from what's happened with interest rate increases. Fundamentals are mixed. And I think, you know, people ask me, "Bob, how is today different from past corrections?" And the three major corrections that I've lived through were the S&L crisis in the early 90s, the recession in the early 2000s with the dot-com bubble bursting, mm-hmm. Russian ruble crisis, Russian credit crisis, 9/11, and then the great financial crisis. And I'll tell you, Jeanette, the two biggest differences that I've seen, number one, the way lenders are handling their problems. And number two is the fact that during those past three corrections, each of the product types were moving in unison, but just to different degrees. Today, different product types are performing very differently. Retail and multifamily are actually performing very well. Land is down, and there are externalities relative to policy that are impacting that. And the office market is really, really having a tough time, and probably will continue to. But there's a huge bifurcation between new Class A office, which is doing well, and everything else. But it is a very, very different correction than we've seen in the past.
Interesting. And thank you for, you know, just a really good historical kind of overview. So, you know, I'm curious to ask you, because right now, rather we're talking about New York or, you know, many other markets throughout the United States, a lot of us are having to, you know, handle some choppy waters because of simply where we are in the economy. What is your pro advice for how to navigate choppy waters, how to navigate these corrections, these seasons of corrections, if you will?
Right. Well, I think it's always important to absorb as much information as you can, read as much as you can, look at how deals are happening, speak to people who are actually in the trenches getting deals done, look at investor sentiment, and go into it with a realization that the market always has been, is, and always will be cyclical. And yeah, it's a challenging time now, but we will definitely come out of this. Just a question of when. I personally believe that when we do emerge from this current market, the comeback is going to be extraordinarily strong, because I think these corrections are very much like a rubber band. And when the market's correcting, the rubber band is getting pulled down. And when it comes back, you let the rubber band go and it snaps back. I think that rubber band is stretched so low today, because this has really been, especially in New York, it's been a correction that began at the beginning of October of 2015. So look, we're you know, coming on 8 years of this, but for that 12-month hiatus in late 21, early 22. So I think the rebound is going to be extraordinarily strong. We're seeing property values in Manhattan today on a price per square foot basis that are the same as they were 15 or 20 years ago.
Wow.
It's just really remarkable what's going on in the market today.
Interesting. Some can say it's grim, and some can say that is tremendous opportunity. It's all about perspective there. So I like your positive outlook on that, very much so.
Well, Jeanette, I think it's grim for folks who have legacy issues. You know, the biggest issue facing owners today is refinance risk. Mm-hmm. An overwhelming majority of refinancings are going to require fresh capital to be injected in order to effectuate that refinance. Overwhelmingly, investors don't want to put fresh capital out of their bank account in to save the building. A lot of our clients are looking at their portfolio, dividing it up into the A's, the B's, and the C's. The A's being the buildings they definitely want to hold on to, the C's are buildings they're willing to sell to get the capital to refinance the A's. So there's a lot of strategic decisions being made by folks who are trying to figure out what they want their portfolio to look like coming out of this. But the legacy issues are the main thing that existing owners are dealing with. As for the opportunity that exists, I always said that the best buying opportunity I saw was during the S&L crisis. Nobody had capital. Banks weren't lending. Over 1,000 banks failed. Properties were dirt cheap. And we're getting to that same point today. You know, there are investors that have a ton of capital that are saying, well, gee, I this is a very compelling opportunity, but I think it's going to be a lower price in 3 months or 6 months. So they're a little bit on the sidelines. Then there are folks who are just, because of politics and policy, have abandoned New York and won't buy here. There are other folks who are optimistic about New York and the opportunities that exist today, but they have to raise capital, and raising that capital has been very challenging. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a, you know, it's a market where you have to have capital and courage. But I really think that, you know, and I've been having these conversations with the uber wealthy folks that I think should be buying today, telling them, look, in the GFC, the values bottomed out in the second half of 2010. But you look at the folks who bought property in 2009, they're dancing in the street with the price that they got their properties for, and they're worth multiples of what they paid at that time. It's impossible to time the exact bottom of the market. And the only way you know that you were at the bottom is 6 or 9 months after you were out of the bottom, and then a lot of those opportunities are lost. So I do think it's a compelling reason to sell. You know, I'm very active on social media, and I've been saying this for the past couple of weeks that I think it's an opportunity. Some people have said, hey, Knackle, you're a guy who makes money when you make a deal. So, of course, you're encouraging people to sell. And I say, or encouraging people to buy. At the same time, though, I've always called it as I see it. There are plenty of times I tell people not to sell. I tell people not to buy. It depends on the circumstances. And I'll say today, I'm telling every single property owner that says, Bob, I'm thinking about selling my building, I'm telling them not to sell. Some have no choice. They have to sell. Others have very strategic reasons. They say, yeah, I'm going to sell for less than I could sell for tomorrow, but what I'm going to take that money and buy is going to be a lower price than I'd have to pay tomorrow. And there are several strategic reasons why people are opting to sell today, but I am telling everyone in New York not to sell their assets today because the conditions are not optimal.
Interesting. And I like what you said, capital and courage, very aptly put. Now, I am curious to dig into a detail that I'm very interested in. So, you know, we focus on multifamily properties and we focus on the Sunbelt markets. New York, honestly, is a market that we just do not have any interest in. And one of the reasons, of course, is because there has been so much in the news recently about, you know, tenant rights, you know, rent control, new efforts to put in place, you know, different policies and procedures. How do multifamily owner and operators really create successful returns for themselves, given those types of constraints that they have to work against? It seems very difficult to have a profitable multifamily investment.
Yeah, well, that is a great question. And I will tell you that the horizon and the landscape of multifamily investing in New York has changed very significantly over the past few years. The political rhetoric that started in 2018 scared the heck out of a lot of the families and high net worth individuals that for decades would only buy apartment buildings in New York. They would never even go to New Jersey. They were only buying New York. And all of the policies that started to be talked about were actually implemented in June of 2019. And I would say 85 to 90% of those families that for decades would only buy New York are buying all around the country and won't touch a New York asset. Mm-hmm. You know, that is, they've made it very, very difficult to extract upside potential out of a property. And I'll bring you back to 1977. The Yankees are playing the Dodgers in the World Series. Reggie Jackson's hitting all these home runs. The Goodyear blimp is over Yankee Stadium. The blimp pans out, and there are 6 fires going on within 3 blocks of Yankee Stadium. Why was that happening? Because in 1977, the dilapidation rate in New York was 14%, meaning that 14% of the dwelling units were deemed uninhabitable. So the city smartly implemented 2 programs, the Individual Apartment Improvement Program and the Major Capital Improvement Program, that incentivized the private sector to invest in the housing stock. So what happened? The private sector invested tens of billions of dollars in the housing stock. And by 2019, the dilapidation rate in New York City dropped to 0.04%. And what did the politicians do in June of 2019? They marginalized those programs such that there is a disincentive to invest in the housing stock today. Mm-hmm. So the fact that you have a system of rent stabilization that is supposed to be a program that makes housing affordable for people, but yet there is no measurement of the income that the people who are protected by this system get. I mean, think about a system of food stamps where you put folks in front of a train station with boxes of food stamps and just handed them out to people randomly without checking to see if folks needed them. That's the way our rent stabilization system works here. It has nothing to do with your ability to pay. It just has to do with confiscating private property to try to create a benefit rather than focusing on what the real issue is, which is to create more supply, which would exert downward pressure on rent. So our politicians today are trying to take private property to satisfy the need we have for housing rather than creating more housing. And every politician I've spoken to, I've said, look no further. Even if you don't believe that economics is a real thing, the Econ 101 textbook is propaganda. Just look at the pandemic. We had a lot of people leave the city because of the vacancy, which is effectively adding supply. Rents went down by 30%. So there are several ways that we could increase the supply with simple policy changes, but yet the legislative session ends tomorrow, which is June 8th, and doesn't look like anything is going to happen that's going to add to the supply. So even though our politicians here say that they want rent to be more affordable for everybody, every piece of legislation that's either been implemented or ignored since 2018 has done nothing but exert upward pressure on free market rents. You can't extract any upside potential from rent stabilized units. So as those units become vacant, they're just basically nailed shut. And the our policymakers are exacerbating the housing problems that we have in New York. So, I mean, we could talk about this for hours and hours, but let's just say it is it's not a business to invest in here for the faint of heart. And it's been proven that price controls actually create more problems than they solve. We've had studies done by the Wharton School and by MIT, both saying that in the absence of rent regulation, average rents would be lower than they are. But it's an easy talking point to try to get votes. And unfortunately, when folks are elected, the first thing they think about is getting reelected. And that has led to some very misguided policy that we have on the housing front in New York.
Well, Bob, this is both fascinating and it is unfortunate. Thank you very much for, you know, being so passionate about explaining that to us and giving us your take of that. It really is very interesting to me. Now, one of the things I'm very curious too, and I would love to know, is what your own portfolio looks like. But first, let's have a word from our sponsor.
Ready to Scale is brought to you by Blue Lake Capital, where we hunt down the best multifamily investment opportunities that we can find and invite investors to join in with us. We target Class B value-add multifamily properties across the Sun Belt. Our CEO, Ellie Perlman, invests a substantial amount of capital into every deal. This means our interests are aligned with yours. If you're an accredited investor looking to expand your portfolio and diversify sponsors, be sure to visit us at bluelake-capital.com. Blue Lake Capital. Be bold, be extraordinary, and keep moving forward.
All right. So, Bob, you have tons of wisdom, tons of insights. You're in the game. You're, you know, on the back end of things. I mean, I'm just dying to know, what does your own portfolio look like?
Well, Jeanette, my own portfolio is very boring. You know, as a broker who has been on commission my whole life, I feel I'm kind of gambling every day in the real estate market. So my portfolio is very, very boring, triple tax-free bonds and things like that. So, you know, most people think I'm a big real estate investor as well, but I'm not. I'm just a broker. Love being a broker. And so my portfolio is non-real estate centric other than the home I live in here in New York and my country house. But I'm a very boring investor.
Now, I'll admit, I already knew the answer to this question because we talked about it off air. But what I actually find really interesting is your rationale behind that. So why is that?
Well, several reasons. One, you know, for 26 years from November of 1988 through December of 2014, I was running Massey Nackle. And every waking moment, all I was really focused on was trying to make that company valuable. Paul and I started the business with the intention of one day selling it. Literally everything that we did was focused on making that company as good as it possibly could be, and making it as valuable as possible. And then after we sold, it was time to do a little introspection, figure out what I really wanted. And what I determined was that I really love being a salesman. I love selling buildings. I have a passion for it. I still have today, which is now at 8 years, 9 years after we've sold the company. I still feel as passionate about it as I did when I started. When I speak to a client and they say, "Hey, Bob, I'm thinking about selling my building," I get as excited as I did back when I was 21. And that's a great thing. So I absolutely have a passion and love for this business. I have no plans to ever retire. I joke around with my friends that, you know, when they put me in the ground, I'll have deals under contract. My wife will have to collect the commissions. But I just love the business. So everything was based. First, it was because I wanted to make the company, very, very successful and valuable. So all my time was focused there. Today, I also believe that doing something halfway is not something that I think works for me. So I'm 100% in as a broker. I think if I'm also buying properties, that creates two problems. One, it becomes a conflict of interest. If I'm buying properties and my clients know I buy properties, when I call a client and say, "Hey, I have a building you should look at," the first thing they're going to do is say, "Bob, if it's such a great deal, why didn't you buy it?" Mm-hmm. And then secondly, I think to do anything really well, you have to be doing it full time. You guys have a great business, but you're focused full time on finding opportunities and trying to get the most compelling options that are available for your capital. That's a full time job. So I don't think I'm willing to do something part way. And I think also the clients who are entrusting me with their properties to sell want me to be working on selling their properties all the time, not trying to increase the size of my portfolio. So for a variety of reasons, and just mainly because I like to just keep things as simple as possible, I've opted not to be an investor in real estate.
Very interesting. And I do respect the sacrifice really that you've made for your career. And I find your perspective to hold a lot of integrity. It very much could be a conflict of interest, and I can appreciate that. All right. Now, last but not least, before we get into what I call the lightning round questions, there's just a couple things more that I would like to know from you. Given, again, the fact that you have been, in the game for a very long time, what would you say is basically some key observations that you have made about the most successful types of investments and the worst mistakes when it comes to
investments? Wow, that's a great question. I haven't been asked that before. So, quickly think. But, I think that the folks who seem to do the best in terms of investing are the people who focus on one particular type of investment. I think that expertise and granular market knowledge are very, very important. I know as a broker, I think being a specialist allows you to become a true market expert. And that expertise and specialization is a way to differentiate yourself from everyone else. And that differentiation actually creates a competitive advantage. I think for investors, it's kind of the same. If you really understand one niche, you're going to understand what the real rent is that you might be able to achieve, what the real costs of renovating buildings are. And the more you're in that one particular space, the more you're going to understand how that investment is likely to perform. So I think the folks that have done the best are the people who really, really understand their business the best. I think that poor investments are made when the proper due diligence isn't done. It's really important. And in New York, we have a market here where you don't get post-contract execution due diligence. All your due diligence has to be done prior to signing the contract. And it, particularly in the apartment building sector, we often tell people that you're not really buying the building that's sitting there. You're not buying the bricks and the windows and the mortar. You're buying the boxes of paperwork that support what the legal rents are and whether the tenants are legal, the rents are legal, what you can be charging. So there's a lot of scrutiny and due diligence that is required. The people who do that best, find things that could potentially trip them up. And if you don't do the proper due diligence, it can create issues for you. So, fortunately, one of the things you mentioned, the number of transactions I did, I closed the deal yesterday. That was sale number 2,257 for me.
Wow.
I tell clients that, that it's nice that I did all those sales, but the benefit to them is I think I've seen every possible tactic that a buyer or seller could use to advantage themselves. Because I only work for sellers, I think I've come across every way that a buyer has tried to take advantage of a seller and can confront that and put my client, the seller, in the best position possible to make the best transaction they can.
Well, very, very great insights. Thank you so much. That is something that I will definitely, take to heart, in looking at your key observations for, some of the ways that people can make the best investments possible, as well as the worst. And congratulations on yet another deal closing. Very exciting. Now, I'm curious, as my last question to you before we do the lightning round, basically the same question, but rather than focusing just on investments, you've also conducted, frankly, just a lot of business. So what would you say are some of the key lessons that you have learned in business?
Well, that's a great question, Jeanette. And I think that the key takeaway from me looking back on, now I'm in year 39 doing this, is that the real estate business, as well as business in general, generally these businesses are people businesses. This is going to sound really corny, but I think realizing that your reputation is everything, that you have to be honest, have integrity. I tell folks in the office, when you're trying to advise a client, pretend that client's your mom or your dad. What advice would you give them? Often the best relationships I have with people started when I told them not to sell their building. And they say, Bob, why would you say that to me? You're not going to make any money. I said, because I really don't think you should sell now. Hold on. Conditions are going to be better. You get a much better outcome if you wait. And so I think just treat people with respect, treat people the way you want to be treated, show kindness to people. Everybody's has a battle that they're fighting in one way or another. So I think just be cognizant of that, but just realize that, I'm a believer that the good guy finishes first. If you take that attitude and also have the attitude, some people have an attitude that business is a zero sum game and every win for you is a loss for me. There are other folks that have a perspective of abundance where, hey, there's enough to go around for everybody. I think certainly in the real estate business, there is enough to go around for everybody. And certainly I want to win as much as I possibly can. But, don't get dissuaded or begrudge other people from having their successes. Also, there's enough to go around for everybody. And I think the folks who have that abundance perspective actually have a happier life. Then somebody's going to get upset every time they see their competitor do something good. So, I think those are the key takeaways is that, it's a small world. Things come around. Just, treat people the right way. Do the right thing, even if nobody will ever know that whether you did the right thing or the wrong thing. But do the right thing, and it just makes a more peaceful life for you.
Excellent advice. I love it, and I very much agree. All right. Well, Bob, now, last but not least, let's do a little bit of fun stuff. Are you ready for our lightning round questions?
I'm ready.
All right. So what do you actually do for fun? Do you have a hobby?
I love to work out and I love to watch my 14-year-old daughter, Sophie, play ice hockey. She loves hockey. We, as a family, my wife, Cynthia, my daughter, we go to hockey games. We travel to see hockey games. I love to watch her play ice hockey. It's great, but that's most fun I have is is spending time with my wife and daughter, which, you know, real estate for me is my job and it's also a hobby. So it takes up a lot of time, but any free time I have, I want to be taking care of my health, get to church and spend time with my wife and daughter. That's the most important thing to me.
Awesome. Love it. All right. Now, what is something that most people don't know about you?
I love to cook. I love to cook. I don't cook in New York at all, but at my country houses in the woods in Connecticut, we have a couple of grills and I grill 4 or 5 times a week. Love to cook. And I also have a weird hobby. I collect game used Mark Messier hockey jerseys. It's a fascinating, to me, a fascinating hobby. I've been doing it for a long time and really enjoy it.
Awesome. All right. Now, what is a book that you would recommend our listeners should definitely incorporate in their library?
Oh, my gosh. I have so many great books that I've read. And one of my mentors is the great Steve Siegel, who's the chairman of global brokerage at CBRE. And Steve told me many, many years ago, said, Bobby, be a voracious reader. Read everything you can. So I love reading books. I have a reading list that I'm happy to send to people. If you email me, happy to send you the list. But one of the great ones is Good to Great by Jim Collins. And he talks about the differentiating factor between good companies and great companies. Great companies latch on to their one hedgehog concept, the one thing that they feel they can do better than anybody else in the world. And everything is directed towards that objective. I think that's a great one. Never Eat Alone, Keith Ferrazzi, The Power of a Positive No, Bill Urey, Bob Cialdini, who's the head of the psych department at University of Arizona, probably the leading authority in the world on persuasion. My Wharton professor, Richard Schell, The Art of Woo. So many great books. There's a ton of them, but send me an email. I'll send you the reading list.
All right. We'll be sure to make sure we include that contact info in our show notes. All right. Now, Bob, one of the things that we always try to really emphasize, too, is that, you know, real estate investing is not just about the real estate. It's not just about the money. But really, you know, one of the goals for us is to help support our investors in building extraordinary lives and living extraordinary lives. So what is your advice for living an extraordinary life?
Well, I think to live a life the way you want to live it, you know, the work-life balance is probably the most elusive thing in the world. That is a different balance for everyone. It's balancing work, your hobbies, your family, your friends, your faith, your health. And everybody has to find their own balance. But one of the exercises that I did a long time ago that I thought was great, and I got it from one of the books I read, I don't remember which one, but they say, you know, pick 4 or 5 people. A work colleague, a friend, a family member, someone from your church or your synagogue, and pretend that you die, and they're going to write a eulogy about you. Write those eulogies, and what those eulogies actually are a blueprint for the way you want to live your life. And you do that exercise, you get so many things out of it, and it's going to change the way you do things every day, every week, every month, every year. And that's really, I think that is the key to living a life the way you want to live it.
Wow, fascinating advice. Very interesting. All right. Thank you, Bob. Now, last but not least, where can people find you if they want to get in touch or get their hands on that book list?
Yeah, always feel free to contact me. My email address is bob.nackal@jll.com. Nackal is KNAKAL. So bob.nackal@jll.com. Or you can follow me on Twitter or LinkedIn or Instagram or any of the social media platforms that I'm on. But always happy to interact with folks if you have any questions.
Awesome. All right. Well, Bob, thank you so much. This interview has been really insightful. I really enjoyed it. Very fun also. And for those of you listening and tuning in, thank you so much for your time. Please don't forget to like, rate, and review the show. Leave us some comments and let us know what you'd like to hear more of. And until then, be bold, be extraordinary, and keep moving forward.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.